lots of us live our lives in this place where we have come to believe that the solution to what's bothering us is outside of us. As soon as you start thinking in a different way, your brain begins to make structural changes to reinforce what you're telling it you want to become true in your life. And you really literally can change almost anything about your life as soon as you're willing to stop being the helpless patient and start being what I call the self-brain surgeon. So your brain and your mind are two different things. This is controversial, right? Like, as you just said, there's a whole cultural moment that we're in that says you do you, you follow your truth, you live your truth. But the neuroscience answer is that about 80%, most researchers now kind of agree that about 2/3 to 80% of the things that pop into your head and the things that you automatically feel are not true.
You're listening to the Visibly Fit podcast. Hey, I'm your host, Wendy Pett. And every week, I'll give you holistic, practical solutions for everyday issues related to nutrition, healing, functional fitness, and behavior modifications. As a naturopath, fitness expert, and wellness coach for over 20 years, my goal is to empower you to reach for greater health and to rise up to your next level of living in mind, body, and spirit. You were created with greatness in mind. It's time to own it. Are you with me? Then let's dive in. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Visibly Fit podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Pett, and I am so excited for today's show. And I know that you are going to be blessed upon blessed after you listen to what my guest has to share with you today. You know, I think so often people are stuck in the way that they are because of their stinking thinking. And I've got news for you. There is a way to change the way that you are living by changing your thinking. And it's doable. It's very doable. You can actually do self-brain surgery. Yeah, that's right. Self-brain surgery. Ooh, what's all that about? Well, today, my guest, Dr. W. Lee Warren, and I wanted to announce that he is a doctor. He just has me call him Lee on the podcast, which is super nice. But Dr. Lee Warren, he is a practicing neurosurgeon. He is a trauma survivor. You'll hear a little bit about that, a war veteran, and he's an award-winning writer. He offers evidence-based strategies for change in his new book, which is called The Life-Changing Art of Self-Brain Surgery, Connecting Neuroscience and Faith to Radically Transform Your Life. And it was just released in February. It is one of the best books I've read in a long time. But Dr. Warren's immensely practical and hopeful guidebook invites readers to discover how changing your mind can change your life. Dr. Lee Warren's life experience includes multiple traumatic events, from serving in the Iraq War, conducting over 200 brain surgeries in over 125 days. And he returned home with PTSD. I can't even imagine. To an unwanted divorce and something else I can't imagine, the horrific death of his teenage son, Mitch. By 2013, his faith and future felt fragile as hopelessness shadowed his daily routine. And then Dr. Warren shifted. He shifted his mindset from patient to surgeon and began to engage the power of his mind to rewire his brain. Self-brain surgery reignited his hope. It rebuilt his faith and it restored happiness that he never expected to feel again. So now this board-certified practicing neurosurgeon of 25 years offers to train people in the practice of self-brain surgery. Since the development of functional brain imaging in the early 2000s, scientists now know that thoughts can direct structural changes in the brain as effectively or even more effectively than medicines or surgery, and can do so much more and do it quickly. This means whether individuals know it or not, every single person on this earth is already a brain surgeon. So Dr. Warren offers to train anyone ready for the next step, shifting one's perspective from patient to doctor. And he is quoted saying, "I was once desperately lost in disordered thinking, in despair over the hard things I had experienced, and asking myself whether life could ever feel okay again." And he says that self-brain surgery changed and maybe saved his life, and it can do the same for you. Let me tell you again, you are in for a treat. enjoy the show with Dr. Lee Warren. Well, hello, Lee. Welcome to the Visibly Fit podcast. I am so excited to have you. I can hardly stand it.
Thank you, Wendy. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, it is so fun. Your new book, congratulations, by the way, just released. And it's one of the best books I've read in a long time. So it's The Life-Changing Art of Self-Brain Surgery. And I, when you first start reading the book, I'll say there's a story about a doctor who is an Antarctic expeditionist, and I cringed when I was reading the story, and I just kind of wanted to, like, let's start with that story, because that's how you open up the book, and then let's talk about how it relates to, you know, just the whole title and topic of your book.
Yeah, so I'll set the story up just a little bit by saying that the punchline of this story is that the way we think about things basically creates what's possible for us. And so just keep that in mind when I tell you this story. 1961, a guy named Leonid Rogozov, who was a very young 25, 26-year-old Russian general surgeon, was chosen, as you said, to be part of the team, kind of the team doctor for this expedition to Antarctica. It was the 13th Soviet Antarctic expedition. And they basically went down there on a ship. They got dropped off with all their gear, and there were 13 or 14 of them. And then the ship went back to Russia, and then the winter came and the ocean froze. And so there's no way these guys are getting back to Russia or anybody getting to them to help them until the spring comes and the ocean thaws out. So they're stuck there, and that's why they sent a doctor with them. So in case anybody got sick. Well, as it turns out, Dr. Rogozov got sick. So he started feeling bad, running a fever, having abdominal pain, and pretty quickly diagnosed himself with appendicitis. So as you know, if you don't have surgery for appendicitis, you often die, even today. And so he was in trouble. Like, Dr. Rogozov was literally dying, and he had this diary that they kept. It's amazing. You can find it online. And he's despairing, like any of us would do if we thought we were dying. We would write, oh, I'm never going to see my wife again. I'm never going to see my kids. You know, I'm never going to get home again. He was really in despair and terrified and kind of freaking out because there was nobody there who could help him because he was the only doctor and he needed a surgeon. And then he had this epiphany. He changed his perspective and he said, wait a minute, I have removed many swollen appendices. I know how to treat somebody who has appendicitis. Like, he started thinking about the problem as a doctor. And he said, if I could just figure out how to solve my problem, then maybe I would survive this. And so he came up with this crazy plan of getting a couple of guys to help him. He had a guy that he trained to hand him instruments and another guy that said, hey, hold this mirror up so I can see my hands. And he told this other guy, if I pass out from the pain, slap me and wake me up. Like, and he took his own appendix out. Like, he literally performed surgery on himself and saved his own life.
Amazing.
And I just tell that story because if you think about it, like, when he was the patient, he was truly hopeless. Like, there was no way he was going to get better because there wasn't anybody to take care of him. And I think lots of us live our lives in this place where we have come to believe that the solution to what's bothering us is outside of us, that we need somebody else to give us the right kind of therapy or write the right kind of prescription or stop doing something or start doing something or change in some way so that we can finally be okay or be happy or be successful or whatever it is. We have this story that the problem that we have is because there's a blank space that somebody else needs to fill. And if Rogozov had continued to think of himself as the hopeless patient, he would have died of his appendicitis. But as soon as he switched his mind, his perspective, as soon as he thought about the problem from a different way, the solution presented itself to him. Wait, I am a patient. Yes, that's true. Because sometimes the things we're thinking about are true, right? But I'm also a doctor. I'm not hopeless and I'm not helpless. I just have to think about this problem in a different way. And then I take that into what we know now from neuroscience in the 21st century, that the way your brain works, most of us believe, is the product of our raising or our genetics or the things that have happened to us. Mm-hmm. And we've come to accept that even in our therapy culture in the 21st century, we've come to believe this idea that we can be broken or messed up or traumatized in a certain way. And we just have to sort of manage that because that's who we are. And we give ourselves all these diagnoses and labels and Instagram profiles and all these things that we tell people. But the truth is, as soon as you start thinking in a different way. Your brain begins to make structural changes to reinforce what you're telling it you want to become true in your life. And you really literally can change almost anything about your life as soon as you're willing to stop being the helpless patient and start being what I call the self-brain surgeon, operating the system from the top down instead of from the circumstances up.
I love it. I love it. And, you know, you have dealt with a lot of patients as a board certified practicing neurosurgeon, and you've seen probably so many people just in desperation, right? Yeah. And, you know, the way that you come at it, I'm sure has obviously given them so much hope in the process, because some people, like you mentioned, they're just wired to think a certain way, and yet they don't realize that they can sever their wiring, so to speak, and
That's right.
and literally rewire the brain. And so I have that in my practice as well. And so I do want to dive right into the way in which people tend to fall into that rut of thinking and feel like they're just kind of a product of their environment, and they are the way they are, and that's just the way it is. Can you talk about how that is really a lie and it's keeping them stuck?
Yeah. So it's not your fault if you think that way, by the way, because
right.
most neuroscientists until the last few years, most college professors, most therapists, most psychologists, most parents, most teachers have taught us that we are the product of our brain activity. In fact, traditional neuroscience literally thinks, literally thinks that what you think of as you is really just the product of the activity of the neurons in your brain. Like there's not even really such a thing as consciousness or free will in that worldview. That everything about you is genetically determined and can be broken or messed up in some way by trauma and can be influenced by environment, but can't really be changed. That's how we were all taught. Like, so it's not your fault if you think that.
Mm-hmm.
But two things have happened. In the early 2000s, we developed something called functional brain imaging. So we can now look at the brain and see what it's doing when people are thinking or moving or whatever. And so now we've learned that the brain is not actually stuck or fixed. It actually constantly changes in its activity, and it constantly changes in its structure. And so what is interesting is that the thing that seems to drive most of that change is what people think about repetitively. And so that sounds kind of crazy, and it sounds like some sort of self-help metaphor, but it's actually the mechanism of how you are able to break habits, form new ones, and memorize or turn anything into what we used to call muscle memory. Like all of those things that you already know are true and that they do work in your life, that you can change certain habits and behaviors, all of that happens because your brain has never been structurally fixed. It's always been changing in response to what you think about. And then it turns out that scripture said that a long time ago, right? Like
That's
scripture's always
say, yeah.
been talking about.
That's good.
Yeah, it always says, don't conform to the way the world wants you to think. Well, what does the world want you to think? You're stuck, you're hopeless, you're despairing because you got to have somebody solve the problem for you. You can't solve it yourself.
Well, because that's how they make money.
Exactly. And that's the reason that some people stay in therapy for 30 years and never feel much better.
Yeah.
Because they keep thinking that somebody else is going to solve the problem for them. Finally, they're going to have a breakthrough. They're finally going to have that moment when they understand it all. But the truth is that what Paul talked about in Philippians chapter 4, about like thinking about different stuff will produce a different result in your life. And now we can put you in a scanner and show that to you, that when you change from, say, anxiety to gratitude, the entire neurotransmitter environment in your brain changes in real time. And so what does that mean? When I say a chemical change happens in your brain, that means that some structural things have to have changed. Genes have to get turned on and off. Different hormones have to get produced. Neurotransmitters get structurally made in your brain in response to the things that you're thinking about. Glands get stimulated. You release or downregulate cortisol and stress hormones, and all that stuff happens. And that's not self-help thinking stuff. That's structural, chemical, physiological, biochemical things that happen in response to what you think about. And so when we say, well, why do people get stuck? Why are people fixed? Why do we not believe that we can change? Mostly because we've been taught the wrong set of things and we have believed them. And then there's this other thing that we've just only recently discovered. I talk about it in the book. The way human brains work is actually built on a series of things that your brain is always constantly searching your environment to look out for threats and to try to make sense of whatever it is that you're seeing around you by recalling memories and tagging them with current events and whether or not there's safety or danger. Mm-hmm. And so that's how your brain works. And what happens is your brain is constantly asking your mind, and I want to separate the the mind from the brain.
Yes, talk about the difference of those two as well. Yeah.
So again, traditional neuroscience says you are the product of your brain activity and that your idea of having a mind or a self or a personality is just an artifact. Now we know, and the Bible's always said, that mind is not a material thing that's stuck in the organ inside your head, but the brain rather is the organ through which the mind expresses and lives out your life on the earth. So your brain and your mind are two different things. And is the audience that we're talking to mostly Christian?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yes.
So then I can say this. Christians often haven't thought about this, but you already believe what I'm saying because you believe that after you die, you still live. And that means you can't believe that your brain is you because your brain's going to be in the ground someday or cremated or, you know, whatever happens to your body. You believe that you're going to be in heaven or not, or you believe that there's an eternal part of you, right? But most of us have never thought about the fact that that has to mean that our brain isn't in charge of this whole thing.
Right.
And so when we put you in that functional scanner, we can ask you to think about certain things, and then we can watch your brain react to what you're thinking about. And then we can watch your body react to what your brain's doing. So we can show you that now, where traditional neuroscience said, no, you're all just your brain. Now we can sort of prove it to you, to them and to you, that you're not the product of your brain activity. You're in charge of your brain activity. Mm,
that's so good, especially with people that have gone through different traumas in their life and that kind of thing. And you have gone through a lot of trauma in your own life.
Yeah.
So you're speaking from experience, from your time in the military and the Iraq War, and then returning with PTSD. I'm certain, gosh, can't even imagine all that you saw and experienced. And then the devastation of your son tragically being killed at age, what was he, 19? Is that right?
19. Yeah, Mitch.
Yeah. So you're speaking from experience of trauma, that you don't have to stay stuck and locked into that trauma. You can overcome. And, I think, yes, my audience is mainly Christian, and they will speak God's word, but it's the belief part, right? That maybe is the disconnect, because in God's word, it says so much that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And we've been, overcome by the blood of the Lamb and all the things, but they're not acting as such. Their brain hasn't chemically been transformed. So let's talk a little bit about your experience through the mental health obstacle, if you will, or breakthrough that you experienced in your own life, and how that has been it's just catapulted you to where you are today.
Yeah, actually, it goes back to that imaging thing we were talking about a while ago. We lost our son, Mitch, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I want the listener to understand, like, I'm not sitting here as a brain science expert. I am that.
Right.
Don't go around calling myself an expert, but I've been practicing neurosurgery for 25 years, so I know a little bit about what I'm talking about. But I'm not dispensing this information from that perspective. I'm dispensing it because this is how I found my life again, and my faith again, and my hope again, and really my purpose for the first time after my son died. So to set that up for you, I had been practicing as a neurosurgeon for a long time before 2013 when my son was stabbed. And I had been a Christian my whole life too, but I had never, Wendy, I had never spent 2 seconds thinking about the fact that I already knew there was a difference between mind and brain, because my training was all in that traditional neuroscience vein
where
you're the brain, the brain's part of you. In fact, my second book that I wrote, the one that won the Christian Book Award, I said in that book that when I do brain surgery, I put my hands on the patient's head and I pray that God won't let me mess them up by operating on their brain. And even in that, writing that sentence, I wasn't discerning the fact that when I cut into your brain, I'm not cutting into your mind.
Mm.
Like, there's a difference. And so I'm just saying, I had to learn this too. And when I learned it was after Mitch died. We were, Lisa and I, and my wife Lisa ran our practice. We lived in Alabama at the time on the campus of, we worked on the campus of Auburn University. And we lost Mitch, and we were, of course, devastated. Like anybody listening who's lost a child, you'll know that unique kind of pain. And for the first time in my life, I'd been bombed in Iraq and gone through 100 mortar attacks. I'd seen the things that people can do to each other. I'd been, devastated by that, and came home, and it took me a long time to work through PTSD and all that. And I'd gone through a divorce. I'd gone through all kinds of things in my life. But until Mitch died, I had never blamed God for any of those things. I had turned to him. I'd been angry. I'd been doubting and all that stuff, but I'd never been really mad at God, and I was mad at God after Mitch died. And I didn't even know. I went through the normal things that people do, which is, how could God allow this to happen? Maybe he's not there at all. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he doesn't love us. Maybe he's evil. All those things that people do, that theodicy stuff, that looking at suffering from blaming God for it. And I think it's reasonable to do that. And I think God is okay with it. That's why a third of the Psalms are laments, right?
Yeah.
But so we're devastated, we're grieving, we're angry. And then we start, we had a practice that had 10 employees, and we basically start getting emails from our accountant that, hey, you got payroll coming up. And if you don't get in there and start generating some revenue, you're going to start letting some people go because the company doesn't have enough money to keep your business open if you're not bringing new patients in the door. Like, you got to go back to work, basically.
Yeah.
This is a reality of owning your own business, right? You got to, at some point, you got to start generating revenue again. And so we went back to work, but we didn't want to go back to work. We had to go back to work. And so we went back to work. And those first few days were really hard. We were crying in between patients, and I was really struggling and trying to just make it through. And somebody had forgotten to cancel a meeting. We were invited to go down and watch some of this functional MRI research happen. And so we went down on the first floor of our building. There was this world-class research center where they were doing this imaging. And functional imaging is different than normal scans. Like, if you go get a CAT scan of your brain, it just shows you a picture of your brain. If you go get an X-ray of your arm, it's just a picture of the bone. You know, is it broken or not broken? But functional imaging is where you can image the organ and see what the organ is doing chemically and cellularly and metabolically and all that. You can see what's happening inside the brain, not just what the brain looks like. So we went down to this to watch this research. I get emotional every time I think about this moment. So I'm this traditional neuroscience trained guy that's never thought about brain and mind being different. And I'm a Christian who believes that you get to live after you die. And that's something I'm holding on to right then because I need to see my son again someday. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm in this broken state, and I'm at this meeting against my will, and I didn't want to be there. And they put this woman in the scanner, Wendy, and they put some headphones on her so they could communicate with her. And they just were calibrating the scanner so we could see what her brain was doing when she wasn't particularly thinking about anything. And then they said, move your right thumb. And so she moved her right thumb, and we saw her left motor cortex light up. And we saw the brain activity in the part of her brain that controls her right thumb happen. And then they said, move your left leg and wiggle your toes and all these things. They could make sure the scanner was showing what it was supposed to show.
Sure.
And then they said, okay, just lie there quietly and don't really think about anything in particular for a minute. And her brain calmed down and nothing was really happening in the brain. And then they said, okay, Mrs. Johnson, think about the worst thing you've ever felt in your life, the worst moment, the worst news, the biggest disaster, whatever it is, the thing that hurt you the most in your life. Think about that for a minute. And you saw her kind of wrinkle her brow up and close her eyes and think. And then her brain began to light up, and the fear and emotional, the parts of her brain that relate to painful emotions, amygdala, hippocampus, that sort of thing. And then shortly after that brain area lit up that's related to pain, her body changed, her physiology changed, her heart rate went up, and her blood pressure went up, and her respiratory rate went up. And we saw her think of something with her mind, her brain react to that thing that she was thinking about, and then her body react negatively to that harmful emotion that she was processing. We saw that happen. And then they said, okay, Mrs. Johnson, quit thinking about that for a second. Just let your brain relax. And everything went back to the baseline. And then they said, now think about your happiest memory, the best thing that you can recall from your entire life, the day your husband proposed or your child was born, whatever it was, think about that for a minute. And so she thought, and then her frontal lobes lit up, and her cingulate gyrus lit up, and her insula lit up, all those parts that are related to happiness and joy and processing happy emotions and all that stuff. And her amygdala calmed all the way down and basically disappeared on the scan. And then her blood pressure came down and her heart rate came down and all the physiology changed. And again, we saw this sequence of thought to brain to body. And my wife, Lisa, was standing there, and she said, hey, that reminds me of Philippians 4. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, it says, don't be anxious, be grateful, and the peace of God will guard your heart and your mind. And if you think about things that are noble and true and good and lovely and all that you'll be in peace. And I saw that. And Wendy, I'm not a charismatic guy. I was raised in a really almost fundamentalist tradition. And I don't go around saying God spoke to me or I heard God's voice or any of that. I'm really careful to not attribute to God something that might be just my brain. And so but in that moment, though, for the first time, one of the first times in my life, I know that he spoke to me. And he spoke to me in my role as a surgeon and in my role as a bereaved father. And he put those two things together. And he said, Lee, when you perform brain surgery, you are intentionally making a structural change in your patient's brain for the purpose of improving their life in some way, right?
Beautiful.
And I was like, yeah. And he said, when you think about one thing and not another thing, you're intentionally making a structural change in your brain for the purpose of improving your life in some way. That's surgery. It's just like the surgery you do in the operating room. It's surgery you can do yourself when you change your thoughts. So and that's good. Where this whole idea of self-brain surgery came alive in my in that moment. And what it did was it put some stitches in those two things and connected them for me in a way that made sense to me as a scientist and gave me some hope that if I could start thinking about what I had gone through with my son in a different way, I would start feeling some different things than I'd been feeling in the few weeks before that. So all those, the despair and the hopelessness and the brokenness and the casting into the future that it would never feel better than this, all of a sudden I could think about it differently. And the physiology was going to back me up.
Yeah.
And it came alive, and I came alive a little bit in that moment. And then that started this, the last 13 years of my life of trying to understand what neuroscience has to say, real neuroscience, not just what people say it says. What does the science say? And everything I've discovered has reinforced something scripture already said. And so that's why I wrote this book.
I love that so much. I mean, it makes me giddy to think about it and teary-eyed because that's how big our God is. Like, he's just so sweet and so sweet to speak to you in a way that he knew would reach you, right? He speaks to us all differently and in different ways and through people and our own thoughts and that kind of thing. But gosh, yeah, see, I get teary-eyed because he's just that sweet. But thank you for sharing that because I think it's important to know your story and to know how God has helped you overcome the deepest, darkest days of your life to give people hope. But I was thinking about, you know, you're talking about the woman that was having the brain imaging and the highs and the lows of her thoughts. And so I was thinking a little bit about just how we're society in general, it seems like we're on a lot of highs and lows based on what we are feeding our, not just our ears, but our eyes from scrolling, the algorithms that we choose to dive into. And so I want to talk a little bit about that because I believe that people are in a place of not understanding how do I get out of this, but because they're staying in an algorithm that is keeping their brain, you know, getting the dopamine hit, like they're loving it.
Yeah.
But that's not how we're supposed to be operating. So let's just kind of talk about that and just the way the world is currently with everything that's being bombarded at us with media.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing how I've done about 60 interviews around this book and in probably half of them, we've discussed social media. Mm. And I think it's because all of us are coming to the same conclusion that it is not a random act of chance that when you spend a lot of time on social media, you become progressively more restless and anxious and not able to be entertained by anything else almost. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is we need to be aware of the fact that the algorithm, as you said, is calculated and designed to keep you on platform, engaging with the platform. And the scientists who program that are aware of the neuroscience you may be unaware of. And what the neuroscience is that the more dopamine you get, the more dopamine you need. And when you get it in a particular way by short-term things that you don't have to work for particularly, then your world becomes progressively more narrow, which is exactly what happens in addiction, by the way. And you can't be satisfied by anything other than that perpetual release of that same neurotransmitter. And so it turns out that the brain science says that once you get sort of into this cycle, this hamster wheel of quick, easy dopamine release, in order to get similar amounts of perpetual dopamine, you have to encounter something a little bit more novel and a little bit more unexpected to get the same sort of neurotransmitter release. And so that's why if you pay attention to your feed, it progressively becomes more provocative or more shocking or more surprising to you over time, because every time you click or every time you scroll and you get that dopamine hit, the algorithm learns from you what it is that you're going to react to. and like or share or follow or decline or whatever. And then it's going to progressively program your algorithm to keep you chasing that same emotion. And so it's dangerous and it's addictive, but that's what's happening to us. We're narrowing our span of what can entertain us and keep us alive.
Yeah. And it's wreaking havoc on our society and our relational, you know, awareness of one another and on our health. I mean, you can get that same dopamine hit by going out for a walk. I mean, I'm into, you know, moving your body, like that's so important. And so I just think, it's just getting people to do the different thing than what they've always done, right? That simple pleasure. It's like that dopamine hit that's just too easy to hit.
Right.
And to practice different habits. So let's talk a little bit about habits because, you know, we're first quarter into the new year, and a lot of people have already kind of set aside those goals or habits that they wanted to put in place for the new year. That usually happens in the first few weeks. But let's talk about how that happens and why do people go back to their old ways of doing things, even though it's painful. Like they're not in a place they want to be, but sometimes I've always said that their pain needs to be greater than their circumstance for them to really change. So is their pain not great enough, or are they just comfortable in their pain?
Well, it can be both, but the other thing is that the way habits form is through this process called neuroplasticity, right? That we talked about earlier. That neuroplasticity means that your brain has a mechanism by which it can connect neurons and groups of neurons based on repetitive things that you think about or do. So anytime you do something or think about something over and over and over, your brain will begin to wire it so that it becomes more automatic. We used to call that muscle memory, right? But now we know it's brain memory. Like you literally make structural connections and reinforce them. And over time, that behavior becomes less taxing on your conscious thought. So you don't have to be aware that you're engaging in the process anymore. And all of a sudden it's automated. And so after you've done something for a long time, you've grieved for a long time, you've been angry about the same thing for a long time, you've carried out a particular behavior, alcohol or shopping or Netflix or Instagram or whatever for a long time, your brain automates it in such a way that you don't have to think about it as much anymore. And that's why you find yourself doing those things when you said, oh, I wasn't going to do that today. I meant to change my diet today or whatever. But in order to change
that's
that.
That's why Paul said what he said.
Exactly.
Why do I keep doing those things?
Romans 7.
I don't want to do.
I don't do stuff I want to do. I do stuff I don't want to do. It's because you made synapses that automated that. And the way to change that requires a tremendous amount of repetition of the new process. And then after a while, your brain starts getting aware that you're trying to make a change, and it starts to degrade the strength of those old connections. And literally, when I say degrade, like there's a process by which those connections or synapses are severed, and the brain parts that made them begin to be repurposed to reinforce the new habit. So it's like if you put a new outlet in your wall, the electrician would have to run a new wire inside your wall to connect that outlet to whatever you were trying to plug up, right? But with the brain, it's as soon as you think about, I want to develop a new habit, it's like the electrician goes and starts to lay down the copper wiring immediately in response to you thinking that you want to do that thing. But in order for it to become permanent, you've got to lay down a lot of those wires, and you have to then degrade the other one. And that takes anywhere between 21 and 60 days to sort of permanently or at least strongly degrade an old habit. What happens to most of us, though, is we give up and we don't persevere long enough for the new thing to become the default thing.
People get caught up in a pleasure trap.
That's right. And the old system is still there. Just like when I used to live in Wyoming, there's a place you can go and you can see the Oregon Trail wagon ruts are still in the ground after over 100 years, because they were so used so often that they were so deep that they're still not gone after 100 years. And that's kind of how your brain works. Those synaptic connections get degraded, but they don't go all the way away. And that's why after years, sometimes an old habit can reinforce itself if you start thinking that that old habit was beneficial to you in some way.
Yeah.
Or you start thinking that the new habit is too much work, or it's too hard, or I'm unable to change, or I just can't get this done. There's still a track.
The words, right? The power of of words. Life and death is in the power of the tongue. So
absolutely,
we do know that. It's good, but it's practicing it, right?
That's right.
Practice. You know, I've said this before on my podcast, but you know, the phrase is practice makes perfect. But I remember my son one time came home from school. He was in elementary school. And I said that to him. And he said, "No, Mom, practice makes permanent." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, you are so spot on."
That's right.
So it's not about perfection. It's about making it permanent and making it a habit. So
but one other thing that before we pivot, there's one other little caveat to that on the neuroscience side that we need to say. A better way to say it on top of what your son said is that perfect practice makes perfect, because the neuroscience means that the way it works is you have to have repetition, but you also have to have intention. Like you have to intend to create this new process. It can't be accidental or sort of by default. You've got to purpose it and will it, and then also do it. And your brain catches on that this is important to you. When there's emotion associated with the change, the need for the change, and there's repetition, those two things together make it more sticky in your brain.
I love that. You will it, because you do have control over your brain. And a lot of people don't quite realize that. It's like, no, I'm telling you what we're going to do next and go for it. That's what we're doing. So let's talk a little bit about, I was thinking about how you often say that, you know, feelings aren't facts.
Yeah.
And because, you know, you hear people say, "Well, that's my truth," or "That's how I feel," and that's just where they're going, and that's how society has, I don't know, they've kind of placated that whole thing. But let's talk about feelings and how they're not facts, and not to get caught up in the deception of that.
This is controversial, right? Like, as you just said, there's a whole cultural moment that we're in that says you do you, you follow your truth, you live your truth. You know, everybody should honor your truth. I heard a sitting United States congressperson recently in an interview say, in an interview, official in their title as a congressperson, said that their feelings are more important than objective truth. That somebody's lived truth is more important than objective truth, that we need to get over this idea of, she actually said, we need to stop worshiping objective truth and start honoring people's feelings.
Oh, wow.
And that's a school of thought that's being taught by therapists, by teachers, by parents, by congresspeople now. And here's the neuroscience answer to that. And the scripture answer is obvious, but the neuroscience answer is that about 80%, most researchers now kind of agree that about 2/3 to 80% of the things that pop into your head and the things that you automatically feel are not true. Mm-hmm. They are chemical events in your brain. They are stored memories that are retrieved to attach to a threat scan that your brain's trying to make sense of the environment, and it's just not true. And everybody listening will understand and immediately agree with me when I say this. How many times have you gotten a text message and read it and had a physiological reaction, gotten mad about it and responded to it, and then realize that you misread it? Or there's somebody writes back and says, "What are you talking about? That's not what I said." And you read it again and you left a word out, or you obviously what you thought they said isn't what they said. And now you're having to go.
Exclamation versus period. Yeah.
Right. And now you're trying to apologize, make up for it, say you're sorry, I didn't mean that. Now you have reacted to something that you felt that wasn't true. And so I would say if you've done that one time, then it would behoove you then to say, okay, well, maybe not everything I feel is true. And if I want to have, well, let's just don't even argue about whether it's more important to honor your feelings or to follow objective truth. Let's just say, do I want to have good outcomes in my relationships? Do I want to have good outcomes with my kids? Do I want to have a good marriage? All of that. If I do, I need to spend less time getting angry about something that I later have to apologize for, right? So that would be a reasonable thing. And if you want to get to that place, then you have to, one thing you have to develop as a practice is something called metacognition. That's what the psychologists call it. Metacognition is this state where humans have this ability that God has given us to think about what we're thinking and feeling before we react to it. So you can say, "Oh, I'm really, this is offensive to me." And you can say, "Wait, why is it offensive to me? Mm-hmm. Let me think about it for a second. Oh, I misread it. It shouldn't have been offensive to me." Like you can think about it before you react to it.
Like do the five why deep kind of questions.
Exactly. So yeah. Most of us live like in this automatic, if I feel it, it must be true. I need to react to it. Or if I think it, it's probably true because it's in my own voice. I need to react to it. So most people never get to that place where they're examining their thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm. That's what 2 Corinthians 10:5 is about, is metacognition. Take every thought captive. We take every thought captive. The point of that is not everything you think and feel is true. And so if you want to be more flourishing in your life, then take a second to think about what you feel and think before you react to it. And if you can do that, on the neuroscience side, what you're doing is you're moving from that fear-based amygdala temporal lobe response that's all about fight or flight and react and get away and react. And it gets into the frontal lobe response, which is reason and logic and decision-making and the idea that you can zoom out and think about a problem from the top down. The switch that moves from anger to that frontal lobe response is in the hippocampus of your brain. And it literally, the hippocampus literally can either send output to frontal lobe or it can send output to amygdala, but it can't do both at the same time. It's a one-way switch. Hmm. And the science works out to where the most important and powerful decision maker about whether you're going to respond in anger or whether you're going to get your frontal lobes involved is gratitude. So if you can think of something you are grateful for, your hippocampus immediately switches off anger and switches on frontal lobe response. That's why Philippians 4 says, don't be anxious, be grateful. In everything with prayer, with thanksgiving, present your request to God, right? And what does he say will happen? The peace of God will guard your hearts and minds, right? So it's true, unequivocally, all the science says it, you can't be anxious and grateful at the same time. And so if you say, do I want to have a robust and flourishing life? And if the answer to that question is yes, then you have to say, I can't listen to everything I think and feel anymore because it's not always true. I need to get meta. I need to examine it, be curious about your thoughts and feelings, and decide a response rather than a reaction. And you'll be better off, but better off than 90% of the people in the world.
That's so good. Such a good word, Lee. Thank you so much. And that's not just about anxiety. It'd be about depression or even ADHD or bitterness, any of those I know one is a diagnosis versus a feeling, but it's still the gratitude overrides, right? So that's really a good word. So let's talk a little bit about how when you do just operate in your feelings, as opposed to taking a step back and overseeing, and why am I thinking this way and doing the 5-why deep, how that impacts just the lives of others around you. It's not just about you. It's your family, your community. Like, it just is a ripple effect. And I just kind of want your take on it and what you're seeing in society right now as we are in this kind of mode typically of feelings versus facts.
Yeah. So I write about this thing I call the two-patient rule. Like when you decide you're going to be a self-brain surgeon, if you're going to decide you're going to operate from a mind-down perspective and tell your brain who's boss and all the stuff we've been talking about here, that every decision you make about how you're going to think or feel or react affects more than just you, like you just said. And that's obvious in some ways. Like, obviously, if you are grumpy all the time, it's going to affect your marriage, right? Or it's going to affect your kids, obviously. But less obviously are some of the things we've discovered now from neuroscience. There's this whole system of neurons in your brain called mirror neurons. And when I look at you on the screen and you have this nice smile on your face, I automatically smile, right? Yeah. Before I'm aware that I'm smiling because my mirror neurons detect your emotional state and begin to mimic that because you have a survival mechanism that says, if I'm matching your emotional state, you're less likely to attack and kill me, right? If we're adversaries, if you look happy and I look happy, we're probably going to get along and not fight. And so that's how God designed that to help keep you alive. But so without speaking, you influence other people's emotional states as soon as they can see you from a distance, okay? So part of how you express your
vibe.
Decision... Exactly. Your decision to be a self-brain surgeon. Now, part of it is, if I'm going to try to make myself flourish more, I'm aware that how I behave and how I'm thinking and feeling and reacting is going to affect other people, even if I never speak to them, because they can see my emotional state. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we know now that there's an electromagnetic field that humans put off up to about 15 meters around us. that affects the heart rate and physiology of other people, even if we're not in the same room. Yeah. And that's what that famous sort of Debbie Downer effect is. And you've experienced this. Somebody angry walks into a room, you just feel bad. You don't even know why. You haven't talked to them. You might not even be looking at them, but you just get a sort of a vibe. It's electrophysiology. Like your heart rate and electromagnetic field affects other people. If you're internally furious, but you're putting a smile on your face and acting, trying to act okay, your people kids will still feel worse than they should, because you're transmitting to them a disturbed internal state that's going to affect theirs. So you have this responsibility then. Like, this insight gives us responsibility, right? Once you know that it's not just about what you say or do, it's also about how you're handling things internally. And that's why Jesus said so carefully, like, that what comes out of your mouth is determined by what your heart is thinking about. That's why David prayed, God, search me and know me and test my anxious thoughts. That's Psalm 34. And then he said, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart. And in the Bible, when you see the word heart or mind or soul, they're conflated. That's the same thing. That's the you. That's not your brain. David says, God, I want my thoughts to be pure. I want them to be pleasing to you, because I know that that's going to affect the words of my mouth, right? And the deeds of my life. So we have this responsibility then, because every time you operate on yourself, you're operating on everybody else too. And the third level of it, and the one that's a little bit scary sounding, but actually is very hopeful, is now we understand something called epigenetics. Yeah. And epigenetics, right? Most people probably are starting to hear about this by now, but when your kids are born, when you were born, you had a set of chemical levels of how much cortisol you have, how much stress hormone you have, how your baseline reactivity to stress is set. That stuff came from the emotional things that your parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents went through. We know now that down to four generations, people who went through the Holocaust, for example, their great-grandchildren are born with elevated cortisol levels, because there are genetic switches that take place in response to that stress that gets inherited.
Yeah.
And so that's why the Bible talks about things like the sins of the father are visited on the third and fourth generation. It sounds like he's punishing your great grandkids for things that you do. He's really just warning you. Like, you need to square away your emotional state in your lifetime.
So you don't pass
because
it on.
Yeah. You pass it on. If you don't heal it, you're going to hurt somebody down the road, even if they never are aware of it. But the good news is, Wendy, we've learned that stuff can be reversed in a single generation. Like, if your kids are already born and they're stressed out because you've been stressed out, if you fix it in you, you will transmit that and it'll get better for them. And in a single generation, those switches can be normalized. And the kids of the people who do the work, they can be born with normal stress responses. Everything gets set right. That's why God says the people who are faithful, it goes on 1,000 generations. Like, if you get this right, it persists into the future. So the old idea that I have to be an alcoholic because my dad was, or I'm going to abuse my kids because my dad yelled at me, that's not true. You can stop it in your generation.
Yes,
and so that, again, it's a responsibility that we have to make it better for the people that come behind us.
So good. Yeah. Being intentional about that and owning your stuff and releasing it and just go doing the work. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I've just got a couple more questions here, because I know you are a busy man on this book tour, so to speak. So again, it's The Life-Changing Art of Self-Brain Surgery. By Dr. Lee Warren. And you give the Ten Commandments is how you kind of break it down. And so let's just talk about maybe your favorite commandment that you write about. I'm sure you love them all because you wrote about them. But what's one that sticks out mainly to you that you want to share with our audience today that can help?
I think that the most important one, Wendy, is the fifth one. Kind of builds, like the commandments in the Bible do, it kind of builds to this plateau of the fifth one. And the fifth one is, I must believe that self-brain surgery is not a metaphor. It's the mechanism of how we can change our minds and change our lives. And it's just really important for you listening to not think that this stuff is some therapy technique or some sort of self-help gimmick.
Yeah, right.
But we're actually talking about how the human brain works. And it works mostly by responding to what you think about. And so you can literally, it doesn't have to be the way it's been for you. If you've been through something traumatic, if you've been through something hard, if you've always been anxious, if you were betrayed and it's broke you 20 years ago and you've been sad for all these years, It doesn't have to stay that way. Like, you can literally change your brain, which then will change your chemistry, change your physiology, change your hormones, body. Change your mm-hmm. your offspring, all that stuff. As soon as you are willing to do the work to learn how to think about those things in a different way, your brain begins to make structural changes that make the new thing who you are. That's why God says that when you get to know him, when you accept what he does, the old person is gone and there's a new person. Like, you literally yes. can become a new person, the renewal of the mind that Romans 12:2 talks about. So the most important one is just to own it, like believe that this isn't some sort of feel better thing. This is a true, literal, actual, physical, structural thing. That's why I call it surgery, because it's as real as what I do in the operating room. And that gives you tremendous agency and tremendous hope that you can be involved in making the tomorrows of your life better than the yesterdays have been.
Yes. And like you said, it takes you having that intentionality and being willing to do the work. And so
that's right.
That's big. Oh my goodness. I could talk to you forever. You are just incredible. I love this stuff.
Thank you.
This is so fun. And again, your book is one of the best books I've read in a long time. And so thank you for heeding the call to write this book so that we could all enjoy and dive deeper and to be reminded of what we're capable of in Christ, and that you know, God's word shares all about this neuroscience thing, and we don't have to be a brain surgeon to understand our brain. Thank you very much for your time. I wanted to end this podcast with on maybe not such a serious note, but maybe just on a little fun personal note. Just curious about what maybe you and your wife like to do for fun. I know you are busy and you have your own podcast and you're a neurosurgeon and, you know, all the things and on this tour, this book tour. But what do you guys like to do for fun? Because fun's important.
Well, we met because we were both on the worship team. I'm a guitar player and she's a singer. So we love music.
But these singing things is evolve. Good for the brain too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But these things evolve. And now I think our favorite thing is we have 7 grandkids now. So we love to play with the kids and enjoy that phase.
Became a Gigi. So it's
congratulations.
Very fun. Thank you. Oh, yeah. That's the best thing, being with the grandkids.
That's right.
I love it. I love it. Well, God bless you, Lee. Thank you so much for your time and for coming on Visibly Fit. I know my audience is going to be blessed, and I certainly was. So congratulations again on your book. And people can go to Amazon and get this. And also, can they go to your website? What's the best way?
DrLeeWarren.com. I've got a podcast and a newsletter and all the things. You can get the book anywhere books are sold. I narrated the audio book too. So.
Oh, good. I love audio too. When I'm out walking, I like to listen to the book. So I'll do that as well. And I will put that in the show notes. So thank you, Lee, and God bless you.
Thank you, Wendy. God bless you.
Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, I told you that interview was just going to bless your socks off. I mean, oh my goodness, I know it did mine. So I hope you share this with others that would benefit greatly. And again, go and get Dr. Lee Warren's book. It is The Life-Changing Art of Self-Brain Surgery, and it is so good. It's really, really a good book. Great read. And I think it can make a big impact in your life if you're feeling like you're stuck or you've got some trauma you're trying to get through or just whatever, you're just ready for change. I think this would help you a lot. So again, share this episode with others. Thanks for tuning in. Love having you as my audience. And thank you. Thank you for your support always and you know, showing up even when maybe you're not sure who the guest is, because I have different people, right? And it might be something about our mindset, might be something about our physical well-being, relationships, emotions. So you just never know what you're going to get. But today was extra special. So thanks again for tuning in. And if you are looking for, and you can go to DrLeeWarren.com. That's his website if you want to learn more about him, but also you can get this book at Amazon as well. And if you are, of course, looking for a transformation, mind, body, spirit, you can definitely go through my program, my 7-week accelerator Visibly Fit program. And you can find that at getvisiblyfit.com. And we would love to have you in our next cohort, but I'm telling you, it is transformational. So if you're ready and maybe you want to read this book first, that'll get you pre-ready. Let's do it together. All right. All right. God bless you. And thanks again for tuning in. We will catch you next time on Visibly Fit. Take care. Well, that's a wrap for today's show. So thank you so much for tuning in. I love spending this time with you. To learn more and get more free resources, just head on over to wendypett.com. And thank you in advance for sharing this episode and this podcast, following and subscribing not only to this podcast, but finding me on social media, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, wherever you are, I'm probably there too. Until next week and our next podcast time together, make it a visibly fit day.